haven't, you know, all that, right after 9/11, there was all that, oh, we're going to improve the training situation. It's like, it's gotten worse.
Yeah, and when flying has gotten a lot worse, and people still do it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I know, yeah.
When they have alternatives.
Okay, so I think if I say anything, this is a pretty basic introduction, but if anything is incorrect at any time, please correct me because I can edit it.
Okay. This is, but just a question. This is a, and this is will be broadcast later.
Yeah.
Okay,
because
that also matters in terms of
right.
Talking about
right.
taboo words.
Oh, okay.
Yes. If it's streamed on the internet, as you know, you can say anything you
yeah.
want, but if it's broadcast, then no.
Right, yeah. right. Okay, good thought. I had forgotten about that part of it. Yeah. And we did mention your talk tonight on some other shows. So even though we're not interviewing you prior to your talk, we did get your talk promoted a little bit on KBOO. So
terrific, thanks.
I felt good about that. Okay. I'm speaking with Harvard professor Steven Pinker, author of The Language Instinct, Words and Rules, How the Mind Works, and Blank Slate. His new book is The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. In this book, he looks at what we can learn about human nature from the meanings of words and constructions and how they are used. Steven Pinker, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
How did you become so interested in these issues of language and the mind?
I've always been interested in the mind. I think it's the most interesting thing there is. It encompasses everything else because reality is, as we experience it, is framed and filtered and constructed through the properties of the mind. And language, since we are verbal creatures, we share what we know and what we understand about the world through language. We negotiate our social relationships through language. We express a lot of our emotions, not all, through language. So it strikes me as a perfect window into human nature, a very rich data source on what makes us tick.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say in the introduction that the stuff of thought is sort of like the completion of two trilogies.
Yes.
Can you talk about how it relates to your other work in that way?
That's right. Well, I wrote a couple of academic books, which are not sold in stores and for my colleagues in psycholinguistics. But the books that I've written since for a wider audience, two of them have been on language. There's The Language Instinct and Words and Rules. And so this is my third book for a general audience on language. But I've also written two books on human nature, How the Mind Works and The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature. And so this being a book on human nature, it completes that trilogy as well. The book really brings my two interests together.
And was that your motivating factor when you started out on this book, or did you have something else in mind?
Well, I think that's my story, and I'm going to stick with it. generally, when you write a book, you have some vague idea of what it's going to be, and as you write it, the book tells you what it has to be about in order to be coherent. So as I was proceeding, I realized that's the book I was writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue of words and thoughts and how the language of thought allows us to frame a situation in different and incompatible ways, that seems to be the thing that starts out your thoughts in this book. Can you give us an example of that process?
Yeah, in fact, that's what was part of my transition from the academic books I've wrote in the past to this one with wider scope. Here's a simple puzzle of language. How come you can say I poured water into the glass, but you can't say I poured the glass with water? I mean, you know what it means, but it just sounds a little off. But with the verb fill, as opposed to the verb pour, you can say I filled the glass with water, but now you can't say I filled water into the glass. Sounds a little bit odd. Then there are some verbs like load, where it goes both ways. You can load hay into the wagon, or you can load the wagon with hay. So what's the deal there? At first I thought maybe these are just quirks, like irregularities, like, you know, sing, sang, but blink, blinked. You just memorize them one at a time. But it turns out there's a rationale. That basically, pour means do something to the water, let it flow, let it go somewhere. Fill means do something to the glass, cause it to change state from empty to full. So even though the matter is moving through space in the same way, we can construe it in two different ways, either doing something to the water causing it to go, or doing something to the glass, causing it to change. Each one of them is expressed in the language in a different way, because the thing that you affect is always the direct object of the verb. So if you're doing something to the water, you say pour the water. If you do something to the glass, you say fill the glass. But that opened up a whole world of ways in which the human mind frames reality in multiple ways. If for something as simple as getting yourself a drink, there are just two different ways you can look at that event and think about it. Just think of what happens in more momentous issues. And indeed, a lot of political rhetoric and argument consists of taking the same state of affairs and describing it in different ways. Invading Iraq versus liberating Iraq. Destroying a human life versus experimenting on a ball of cells. Redistributing wealth versus confiscating earnings. Once you start to be aware of it, you see that people often disagree not on what took place in the world, but on what categories to put them in. I don't think it's a matter of language itself. It's not just words. I think the words reflect different implicit theories and explanations and moral systems. So even though language is a window into these different ways of framing reality, I don't think we're trapped in a game of words. We just have to be aware of the mental concepts that underlie these different ways of describing a situation.
And so this is an issue that you refer to in the book, that the whole issue of framing, and I think many of our listeners are familiar with the work of George Lakoff and how he talks about framing. Can you talk a little bit about how you differ with his look at the use of framing?
Yes, and I wrote a rather critical review of his book, Who's Freedom in the New Republic, which I have a link to it on my website. And I've got to say that I admire Lakoff's work in linguistics tremendously. He's truly a brilliant linguist, one of the most important in the field today. And he's done much to enlighten us on the ubiquity of metaphor in ordinary conversation, not poetic ornaments, but just you can't help but talking metaphorically. Metaphors saturate our language, as in what I just said, saturate. It's not really a liquid in a sponge, but as Lakoff would put it, that reveals a kind of mental model in which we think of information content in terms of a container or medium and then some sort of fluid or content. Where I think Lakoff becomes too extreme is in suggesting that all or most abstract thought is metaphorical, and that a way to change people's minds politically is to switch the metaphors. So to reframe taxes as membership fees, to take a notorious example, where I think Lakoff has a rather Pavlovian theory of human learning, that we these frames and metaphors get stamped into our minds by sheer repetition and a kind of conditioning. And I think the mind is more sophisticated than that. Membership fees is kind of a joke. I mean, it's a good thing the Democrats didn't take that advice. And one of the reasons is we do, at least when we're paying attention, we can think beneath the metaphor. We can dissect it. We can look into it. And as soon as you think about it, you realize that taxes are not membership fees. If you don't pay your membership fees, the club will drop you from from the organization. If you don't pay your taxes, men with guns will put you in jail. That's a pretty big difference in a democracy. And you can't really pull the wool over people's eyes as easily, I think, as Lakoff suggests.
Mm-hmm. And yet, it seems that he maybe did some of his thinking after knowing about Republican strategists who used the reframing, and I don't know if they used that as the term, but they adopted their words for how they would talk about things based on research done on how people relate, you know, very So how do you?
I think that's been done since the dawn of time. I mean, I think that's what the art of persuasion consists of. And though it's true that the Republicans have been pretty good at it. It's not as if the Democrats and the left have been immune to those tactics. Like, take trickle-down economics as an alternative framing for supply-side economics for reducing tax rates. Well, the rich get all the benefits, and then the middle class and the poor have to wait for some tiny fraction of it to trickle down. So for that, that's an example of reframing on the left.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, another person, thinker, who is well known to cable listeners is Noam Chomsky. And I just wanted to get a sense of how you were influenced or not influenced by him, because I believe that he was important in your background.
Yes, true? I mean, he wasn't a mentor or an advisor or anything. In fact, we're really in different fields. I'm a psychologist and he's a linguist. Certainly my views on language were influenced by Chomsky. The idea that the best way to study language is to look at what goes on in someone's head, to think of language as a cognitive construct. The idea that the power of language comes from combinatorial recursive rules, that is, recipes or algorithms where you can combine words into bigger and bigger units to express an infinite number of thoughts. And the idea that the key to understanding language is to understand how it's acquired by children, and that children couldn't succeed in acquiring language unless they had something of the logic of grammar built in. Obviously not the words and constructions of a particular language, but enough analytical abilities so that when they hear language coming out of their parents' and siblings' mouths, they chop it into words, they listen for possible grammatical regularities in particular ways, and that's a key to explaining how kids acquire language, and a key to explaining the structure of language, because it has to be learnable by children. Mm-hmm. So that's those very large and important ideas were strong influences. Also, I guess the idea that language is not just a byproduct of general intelligence, but that the brain has some specialization. That is, that it's different subsystems of the brain are specialized to different cognitive feats, to understanding other people, to understanding the physical world, to understanding different kinds of social relationships, and to understanding language. We differ. We don't. I'm not politically. I'm not in Chomsky's camp, and I haven't been sort of jumped onto the political bandwagon that he leads. That's very popular among linguists and in college campuses in general.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to let people know that I'm speaking with Harvard professor Steven Pinker about his latest book, "The Stuff of Thought: Language as a Window into Human Nature." I know you touched on the idea of metaphor before, but I wanted just to try to understand why metaphor is so important throughout your book, and just for myself, try to understand how metaphor is so important to the way we live our lives, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and this very much relates to George Lakoff's work, and I think there's tremendous insight in there. It's very hard to find a stretch of language that isn't packed with metaphors. And I did it again, packed with metaphors. But we talk about, you know, the economy rising and falling. We talk about, I'm going to have to force myself to be nice tonight, as if there were two agents inside my skull, one of them, you know, manhandling the other. We might say of a relationship, we've come too far to bail out now, even though we've hit a rocky patch, as if love is a kind of journey. What's interesting is not just that there are lots of them, but they tend to cluster around a central metaphor that is never explicitly stated, like love is a journey, like the economy is an object that has a position in space, like the mind is a group of people arguing with one another. And the fact that each one of these core metaphors spins off lots of concrete metaphors, and we can understand new ones, you know, in a relationship, I think we should step on the brakes for a while. That's not a cliche. Everyone understands what it means. It must mean that the similarity between a relationship and a journey is alive enough in the mind that a new form like that can be readily understood. Now, I think it can be taken to extremes, and I think that Lakoff pushes it farther than I would be willing to push it. I mean, in one extreme, the mind is very concrete, that all abstract thought is played out on a little mental stage in terms of little marbles moving around or little people shoving each other. The other extreme, which I think Lakoff doesn't consider, is that the metaphor is alive mainly in the mind of the coiner of the metaphor, the first person who uses it. You've got to find some word to talk about a new concept. Why not reach for one that at least has some similarity? It's the one that first occurs to you. Maybe your first listeners will figure out what you mean more efficiently. But then it quickly dies, becomes a dead metaphor. And for people who use it, it's just the particular way in the language in which you express that concept. And you see, obviously, a lot of metaphors must be dead metaphors because people mix their metaphors in ways that they couldn't if they really had an image. Mm. So if you say, well, whenever you open up a can of worms, they always come home to roost. or the ship of state is sailing on a one-way street. People who overuse literally when they mean figuratively, of which my favorite example is the defender of Richard Nixon during the Watergate scandal, who said the American press has literally emasculated President Nixon. And clearly, he didn't think through to the image behind his words, and so the metaphor obviously was dead. Now, I think the truth is probably in between. That is that metaphors are alive for certain metaphors are alive in the mind of certain speakers at certain times. Others have solidified into just conventional memorized labels for concepts.
And metaphors seem like an incredible thing for children to learn or to pick up. I mean, it just, to me, seems, you know, incredible that they are able to learn what a metaphor is.
Yes, I mean, well, some of them, the ones that are, there must be many that they don't realize are metaphors at all. And as with the case of the adults who mix their metaphors or use literally in a figurative sense. But metaphors also must be alive in the minds of children because they do say things that an adult would find surprising that they clearly didn't just reproduce from adult speech. Like, can I have any reading behind the dinner? Meaning after dinner, where they use the space for time metaphor. The order of events in time is represented by the metaphor of objects along a straight line. My dolly is scrunched from someone, but not from me. We would say by someone, and there it's as if causality is a force that flows from the agent to the thing that's affected, and hence you use the spatial term from. So children do can sometimes at least see through figures of speech to the underlying metaphor and then spin off variations of their own.
Mm-hmm. In writing about words and reality, you use the now well-known controversial statement by President Bush about uranium from Africa. The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. How does this particular statement exemplify how our words connect with reality?
Yeah, we have a we're implicit realists when it comes to language. Even if academics might argue that reality is a social construction and no one can ever know what's really true, what's really false, in our everyday conversation we act as if that's not true, and that words do have a definite relation to states of affairs. And a word like learn is an example. I mean, it's what linguists call a factive verb. That is, you only use learn and other words like know and remember when you're committed to something actually having happened and you expect your listeners to share that same sense of certainty. So the logic, the best explanation of what a factive verb is in a wisecrack from Mark Twain. I used to remember everything, whether it happened or not. Now I've gotten older and I can only remember the things that didn't happen. Now, why is that witty? It's because you can't remember things that didn't happen. You can misremember, but the verb remember presupposes that the thing that you remember really did take place. That's true of know as well. You can't know that the moon is made of cheese. You can think that the moon is made of cheese or believe that the moon is made of cheese. You can't know it because the moon isn't made of cheese. You and I, in using language, have a background model of reality, a fact, and certain verbs have to tap into that shared understanding. Now, learn in most contexts is a factive verb. When Bush said British intelligence has learned that Saddam has sought to buy uranium in Africa, that implies that it's a fact, not a conjecture, not a strongly suspected belief, but it is known, at least by whatever standards we can know anything. That turned out not to be true. Crucially, it's not just that that he was mistaken and British intelligence was mistaken about Saddam trying to buy uranium in Africa, but at the time, there was the information was very, very far from certain. If you say learned, you're implying that as far as you're concerned, it's certain, and the doubts had been expressed within the White House, and so I think a case could be made that that was a lie.
I wanted to also get into the issue of naming and how that, how you have a whole section on naming and how it connects us to the outside world. Can you talk a little bit about that as a section of what you're dealing with in this book?
Yes, I try to explain a famous philosophical theory or even a philosophical discovery. Some people consider it to be one of the major discoveries of the 20th century philosophy, which is that names are not like definitions, but rather names are more like pointers to the world. So what does that mean? Well, we all know what a word like a senator is. You look it up. It's defined by the laws of the government. Likewise, a dollar is what the government decides a dollar is. But what about words that we use in everyday conversation? And what about names? So does William Shakespeare, for example? You could look it up in a dictionary, and you'd get a definition. 17th century English playwright, wrote Romeo and Juliet, etc. But is that really what a word means? Well, not really, because you can imagine a bunch of hypothetical situations. Let's say scholars proved the conspiracy theory about Shakespeare's plays, that he didn't really write them, but they were written by Marlowe or De Vere or whoever your favorite theory points to. Let's say he didn't live in Stratford, but he lived next door in Warwick. Let's say that he wasn't really an actor. He was just a carpenter, but everyone thought it would be fun to pretend that he was an actor. Would we then say that he wasn't William Shakespeare? Well, no, he's still William Shakespeare. He's still the little boy that Mr. and Mrs. Shakespeare named William, even if all of the facts that we associate with his name turn out to be mistaken. So what it suggests, this is a theory from proposed in different forms by Saul Kripke and Hilary Putnam, two well-known philosophers. What it suggests is that the meaning of a word can't be unpacked in terms of a bunch of other words or concepts, but it really gets its meaning from the fact that some dubber at some point in time pointed to something in the world, said, this is, in the case of Shakespeare, this is William Shakespeare, and through a chain of transmission, the name stuck and reached us in the present day. And that may be true even of, not just of names for people, but of names for natural kinds, that is, things that we find in nature, like cat and gold and water, that the definition of water may not be H2O. The definition of water might be the same stuff as whatever the first guy who used the water pointed to the first time he used it. And so words aren't completely in the head. They also involve links to the outside world.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of takes us into another area that I wanted to touch on, which is the social relations and how they relate to language. And you have a whole section on why do we have all these rituals for using indirect speech and how that takes us into the social world of language.
That's right. So if I were to say to you, would you like to come up to my hotel room and see my etchings? You would probably look askance at that and realize that etchings may not have been what was on my mind. Or if someone were to say, oh, nice story you got there. It would be a real shame if something happened to it. You would interpret it as a veiled threat. Even polite conversation is indirect. If someone says, can you pass the salt? It's not as if they're asking us whether it's too heavy to lift. They're just requesting it, but in a roundabout way. And a lot of our speech is roundabout. This isn't, for me, this isn't just a puzzle of why. Why don't we just blurt out what we mean? Why don't we just say, give me the salt, or if you don't pay money, we'll torch your store, or do you want to come up and have sex? It's also a significant political and legal problem in, for example, in the crafting and interpreting the language of diplomacy. Diplomats often spend an awful lot of time being vague and muddy and indirect, because if they were too clear, no one would sign the treaty. In the prosecution of bribery and extortion and sexual harassment, you have to deal with what the real meaning of an overture is, because most of those crimes are evaded by doing them indirectly. So sexual harassment. Remember Clarence Thomas, he got into trouble for saying, "Who put pubic hair on my coke?" Which Anita Hill interpreted as a sexually provocative remark. Well, you know, was it or was it not? Likewise, bribing politicians. How do all those lobbyists in Washington get a why aren't they all in jail for bribery? I mean, that's what they're doing. I mean, you know, you know it, I know it. And the reason is they do it through innuendo rather than in so many words. And so the legal system lets them pass under the radar, especially when and there's some argument that it involves freedom of political speech.
And finally, the area that I wanted to talk about, that it's close to me because working in radio for quite a long time, the issue of freedom of speech as it's applied these days is very interesting to me and something I have to deal with almost every day. I mean, we have trainings here on indecency and obscenity and what can be said and what you can't say and how much you'll get, as a volunteer, you'll get penalized if you let a word go out over the air. We were actually won a case, one of the last to be won, where we challenged the FCC's ruling that we had allowed indecency over the air. And that's not going to happen under the rulings that have happened since the Bono decision.
Yes.
So very interesting to read that chapter in your book. And your question, I think, is so great. Why would a democracy sanction the use of government force to deter the uttering of words for two activities, sex and excretion, that harm no one and are inescapable parts of the human condition?
Yes.
What do you come up with
It's a tremendous a paradox. I mean, in some sense, we're living in a free speech utopia. I mean, I can say, you know, George Bush is a liar and a moron, and your radio station won't get fined. I won't get thrown in jail. I won't have my tongue cut out. I won't be burned at the stake. A few hundred years ago, I mean, that or worse would have happened. On the other hand, if I said George Bush is a freakin' liar, and I didn't use the word freakin', but a synonym, then your station might be put out of business. It's not as if anyone doesn't know the words. Why, in this ocean of free speech, do we have these islands of censorship? All cultures have some kinds of linguistic taboos, including progressive ones that tolerate free speech about sexuality. I noticed coming into the station that there were a number of signs and placards about what I couldn't say, so that they're about, you know, sexist and racist and homophobic language. And indeed, the most taboo word in America today isn't the F word or the S word, but the N word. So it's not as if anyone is free of linguistic taboos. I think the reason that we care so much is, first of all, that words are processed automatically. When you hear a word, you can't not think of what it means and how it was intended to be used. There are a number of experiments that show that. Also, words involve negative emotions, so taboo words, even though how you swear in one language is very different from how you swear in another, or even in the same language at different points in time. For example, you know, bloody and damn could have gotten us into trouble 60 or 70 years ago. Now they're okay. But there is a common denominator, and that is strong negative emotion, whether it's awe and dread of the supernatural, disgust at bodily secretions, hatred of disfavored groups of humans, revulsion at sexual depravity. They're always very touchy feelings that go into taboo words. And so swearing is a kind of weapon. I can cause you to think a negative thought just by making noise, since your brain automatically interprets that noise in terms of the negative thought. And in addition, it's not only that I can get you to think those thoughts, but by using a taboo word, I'm communicating an extra layer, saying I'm doing it in order to offend you. And that's why some words like excrement are unpleasant, but they're not taboo. You're not going to get fined for my saying them, whereas a particular synonym would get us all in trouble, because the synonym signals not only am I talking about it, but I'm talking about it in order to offend you. So there is something that is inherently offensive about these words. That's why we use them, because sometimes we do want to offend our listeners, or at least in the mildest form of swearing, at least arouse their attention, taking advantage of the emotional punch of taboo words to wake up a listener or to get them to take our words seriously.
Mm-hmm. But the whole issue of them being banned just seems so arbitrary still.
I agree. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with a radio station or a network having a house style driven by the demands of the market that say, we're appealing to listeners who don't like to hear those words, so we're not going to use those words. That's fine. I mean, who could object to that? But why the government should feel it has an interest in banning those words? Granted, sometimes people might be offended if they stumble upon a radio station that they don't ordinarily listen to and they hear these words. But there are all kinds of things that are offensive on the radio that the government doesn't ban. Mm-hmm. I'm offended by lots of stuff on the radio. I don't want the government to outlaw them. I think private decisions, house style, standards of taste voluntarily adopted, well, who could be against that?
You mentioned that you looked at our signage. Is that, given your interest in language and the work that you do, are you always looking at signs and trying to decipher what's going on via language in different environments that you get into?
Oh, yes. I'm always sort of have an ear cocked for interesting or puzzling usages. I used to have little yellow post-it notes in my wallet where I would write something down. Now, with electronic gadgets and Palm Pilots and so on, I just tap it into the gadget. Because one thing you quickly learn is that human memory is terrible for exact wording. And so, I heard this really cool thing or saw this interesting sign. Oh, gee, what was it? So you got to write it down then and there,
right?
Which I do.
Well, Steven Pinker, this is a very interesting book and deep. I'd like to go back over it when I have more time and kind of absorb some of the material in there, because there's a lot to think about. And I want to thank you for coming into KBOO and talking about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
And let people know again, I've been speaking with Steven Pinker. The title of his latest book, The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. And you mentioned your website earlier. Could you tell us what that is?
Yes, pinker.wjh.harvard.edu. Or if you Google Steven Pinker, it's the first hit.
Okay, great. Thanks again. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO.